This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you again by our sponsor, the MagicBookshop.com. You ought to go and check them out because they get new arrivals each week of old and out-of-print books. And if you're looking for some rare find that you can't find anyplace else, you might want to go check them out. While you're there, of course, they have the newest as well. Also, I want to welcome the newest friend of the Magic Word. That's Mr. Chris Shepherd. Thank you, Chris, very much for your pledge to the MagicWordPodcast.com. That means so much to me, and I appreciate your pledge and those of every other friend of the Magic Word who have pledged or donated, made a one-time donation or a monthly pledge. That it's all appreciated, but never more than just now. I mean, I understand that everything is pretty tough, of course, and everybody is trying to scramble for every little bit that they can get and finding different ways of course of doing it. And so I was surprised whenever that you had elected to make that pledge, and it certainly means a lot. And I know I haven't been asking for that during this difficult time right now while everyone is kind of sheltered in place, and a lot of people are worried about where their income is going to be coming from tomorrow. And so again, I certainly do appreciate it. And so I again want to thank you and the rest of the friends of Magic Word and the sponsor for helping to keep this podcast going. Well, this week we're going to get to speak with somebody who has been touring with The Illusionists. And when they came through Houston a few weeks ago, I didn't realize that that was perhaps one of the last of their shows. I don't know how many more that they actually went on before they finally shut down the touring show, as all the rest of the shows have been shut down then as well. But I spoke with Martin Cox, who was from the UK, and he had been a guest of mine for a couple of nights while he was passing through doing a lecture tour here recently. And he had suggested that I talk with his good friend, Jonathan Goodwin, who is an escape artist. Now, I haven't really had an opportunity to sit down and talk at length with an escape artist. I've spoken with Spencer Horseman a time or two on the podcast, just in some convention reports, but I really haven't chatted with him at length. And it's not just the escapes that are of the ordinary type, and I say ordinary where you're doing a water torture or a straitjacket escape, etc. But I like where Jonathan's going with this, and the idea where that he's trying to figure out what it is that the audience needs. What are they looking for, and what do they actually believe, and how much jeopardy can one get into that would be permissible? And also, I guess, what is he willing to, what level of risk is he willing to accept? There are a lot of really interesting things he's talking about here that I've never discussed with anybody, because I've never met anybody who is quite like this, who has this kind of a background and this experience. And the stories he tells, well, you're going to hear some good ones from Mr. Goodwin. See what I did there? Please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Jonathan Goodwin, here on The Magic Word. Well, today we are going to be doing something a little bit different. A few weeks ago, I spoke with Jamie Allen from the UK, who is an illusionist, and I don't often, as I mentioned then, I don't often get an opportunity to speak with people who are illusionists. Most people I talk with, it seems like, are close-up guys or mentalists or something, you know, and so we've got another opportunity to speak with someone who is a stage performer, and not only that, he is well-known throughout the UK and in the US, has been performing here with part of the group with the Illusionists, doing an nationwide tour, and he is someone who has been on a lot of television shows, star of stage and screen. So he has performed in his own series, a couple things we'll be probably talking about while he was in the UK. And also, it's kind of interesting, I think, that he is in has unique status that within 1 year that he had performed not only in the West End in London, but also in Broadway in New York City within the same year, which is kind of impressive that everybody gets to do either one of those, let alone, you know, in the same year and everything then too. And I would hope that if you have not seen him on YouTube or on any of the Got Talent shows, that you will go and take a look. I'm going to post a couple of those on the website at themagicwordpodcast.com, so you can get a chance to see some of his act, and of course then to visit his website. But we'll get into that a little bit. But it's a new friend of mine, someone that I'd met through Martin Cox, a mutual friend of ours. So please welcome Jonathan Goodwin. Hey, Jonathan.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm fantastic. Thank you very much for your time here this afternoon.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So you're with The Illusionist. My first question really is who else is in the tour? I know The Illusionist kind of swaps out different people.
It does. I've done this tour actually for a while, probably close to 5 or 6 years now. I've been touring with The Illusionist, and it changes a lot. So right now in the show we have David Williamson, who everybody I'm sure will know. Mm-hmm. There's a British mind reader called Chris Cox. He's very good, very entertaining. There is a Korean sleight of hand guy called Hyunjun Kim. And a French illusionist who is kind of pretty new on the scene. His name is Valentin Azima. He's also very charismatic and really good too. So it's just the five of us, and it's a really fun show.
Yeah.
You get a mixed bag. Every time we throw one of these things together, different personalities and different things mm-hmm. sort of collide. And this one's really lovely. Everybody's very sweet.
And how is that, traveling with everybody? I mean, you have to kind of, when you're thrown in together to begin with, kind of in this soup, and you're trying to make it taste right, you know, that who produces this to make sure, I guess, that they have the right mix of people or different talent?
So there's a company that have produced the show since, I think it started in 2012, I think I have that right, before I was involved in the production.
Mm-hmm.
And it's...
well, that would have been back when Jeff Pobson and Kevin James were involved.
Yeah, Jeff was in at the beginning. Kevin was in, and there were, I think Dan Sperry was,
yep.
was one of the original performers. It was a very different show. Originally, it toured with a live band. When I came in, it was sort of maybe the last year that they had the band, and I work with all of those guys. They're all good friends, but you know, as these things go on, you know, people go off and do other projects, and it's a very successful entity, and so there's no shortage of people that want to kind of.
I'm sure that's true. I mean, after people see this, some illusionists or stage guys or mentalists might come over and say, "Hey, I can do that. You know, who can I talk to? You know, I want to kind of fill in." So you probably leave a trail of other magicians who are saying, "I want to do that."
Yeah, 100%. And you know, over time, it's become more successful. The company got bought out last year by Cirque du Soleil.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So technically now we're a Cirque production.
Okay.
And
how has that changed?
It hasn't really changed very much at all.
It's just meant for the management at top that.
Yeah.
So you don't see it on the day to day as far as the production quality or.
No.
Did they put more money into it or.
Not really. Although it's, you know, it's all new. Like it's a very new endeavor, and I think that all of the changes that are happening on a managerial level are still ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
But from the point of view of what impact that has on the show, nothing really. It's you know, I think they bought a product that was successful, and mm-hmm. I think it would be crazy for them to come in and change it. And
if you got a Rolls Royce, then why should you try and change it into a Vega? You know,
exactly. And you know, I think there were people that have been in the company for a while who were worried that, you know, we were all going to be forced to wear face paint and that kind of thing.
Sure.
But I don't think
learn how to do acrobatics.
the company's very successful, and actually they operate incredibly, you know, incredibly efficiently. They don't just do magic shows. They have circus shows and other things. They actually have almost as many tours currently running as Cirque does. And yet there's about 10 people in the office.
And where are they located? What's the head office?
They're based in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And so I think that's one of the reasons why Cirque was interested. They were like, how do you do this? You know,
yeah.
So, which is ironic for a magic company, but no, they're very successful. They really know magic. They know how to put on a good show,
mm-hmm.
And then obviously they understand that the one thing that's different, I think, between traditional Cirque shows and our show is that it's personality led. You know, we are what make the show good, because the audience get to know us. And I think that's one of the important things about, you know, what makes magic such an effective art form is that, and also I think it's really important from the point of view of, you know, if you're learning magic or getting into magic, that the key to making it successful is how do you make people care, you know, above just doing a trick, which is basically the same as someone.
So what's your answer? What is your recommendation? How do you make people care? How do you create that brand?
Well, there are lots of different ways of making people care. I think that first and foremost, you sort of have to make it relatable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a friend in the UK, someone that you guys may know, called Jeffrey Durham.
I know
Jeff, but he says in his lecture, nobody ever wanted to see a magic trick, but they might not mind watching someone they like do one. And I think that's really important, you know. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing, you know, especially with my stuff, because obviously I'm not really a magician, actually, although it is my background.
Mm-hmm.
I
consider yourself an escapologist, I assume.
Yeah, and a stunt performer. But I was a magician for the longest time, and then once I started to get into escapes and stunts, I don't think they go together very well. Like, I don't think you can flip back
Separate and forth
between doing magic tricks and stunts and escapes, because it undermines the stunts and escapes. If people think that it's a trick,
sure.
Then I don't know what to believe anymore. So I drew a line in the sand, and I don't do that stuff anymore, although I write and consult for other magic performers, because I still have that sort of funny bone, as it were.
I understand that. You know, I used to, do seances from time to time, and the guy that I was doing the seances with, that we had like a mix and mingle beforehand, and when we first got started, I was doing some magic during the mix and mingle, and then we would do the seance, and I felt that people believed that they were just tricks we were doing in the course of the seance, so I changed my close-up performance with that mix and mingle to be more of something that would be macabre and bizarre, so it had a story to it, you know. So instead of just an invisible deck, you know, I would have like a little skeleton hand, you know, on it or something, and with a glorpy, you know, so that way in other words, you tell a story to kind of make it creepy a little bit, and something that people are not going to be laughing and applauding. It's like, huh, how'd that happen? So then you kind of prepare them for that, you know. So I think it's the same thing that if you are doing magic, it would take away from the escapology, because they would think, oh, if he's already done that, he must have this thing gimmick somehow or another also, you know.
Sure. And I think that, you know, from my point of view, if you are asking people to care whether you live or die, they've got to like you, you know.
Ah, and wow, so, that's really interesting. You're right.
And so you it has to be personality led, and if I'm doing something, you know, I do lots of very dangerous, stupid things. You know, I set myself on fire, and I you know, I've hung from helicopters, and all manner of different things, and none of those things are relatable to most people. None of those things are things that people watching can go, oh, I know how that feels, or I can see myself wanting to do that, because why would nobody wants to do that?
They may want a bungee jump, but that's about the extent of
exactly. And so, if I'm going to connect with an audience like that, I have to do it on a level that, you know, I have to find common ground. I have to find things that people can connect with me on, so that I can then take them to that place, if that makes sense.
Let me ask you then, when you do television shows and you have a short snippet, let's say like Britain's Got Talent, you're just coming out and doing the trick, you know, doing the escape.
Sure.
It's hard to, and same thing with a mentalist, you know, to try to get people to understand and start to believe that you do have these powers to bend silverware, whatever it is. And when you've got 90 seconds or something, you know, it's a story, I guess, they tell beforehand to try to get people to be interested and to want to root for your success.
Sure. That's the key, actually. My background, aside from magic, is television. I wrote and produced a bunch of television shows, both in the UK and in the States. And so it's a language that I'm very familiar with. And your story, your act in those shows begins the moment that you're on camera, which is actually maybe 8 minutes or something, four or five minutes before you're actually on the stage doing your performance.
Actual performance, right.
And so the interviews and the B-roll and all of the sort of character material that they create in order to introduce you to the television audience, that's the beginning of the act.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important, if you're ever going to do one of those shows, it's as important to think about that stuff as it is about, you know, the act is. In fact, in many ways, it's more important because those shows are popularity contests.
Huh. That's a good point. So they got to love you from the moment you walk on because they already kind of know you because of that little snippet that they have seen about you. Which is a sizzle reel, basically. You're talking about how to make a sizzle reel.
Yeah, and also, I think it's really important that you know who you are, because how can you expect an audience to know if you don't? You know, like presenting what you do as a unified front, so that everything fits and is thought about from the point of view of, you know, what you wear, the material that you've chosen, the angle that you want to take. And I'm talking specifically about those Got Talent shows that you know, there are hundreds of thousands of people that you know, and certainly lots and lots of people that are incredibly skilled, top of their field, and you have to create that interest. Like, why do I vote for this person versus that person? And most of the time, it's going to be either a taste thing, you know, and that's something that I fight actually, is that there's a product in the UK called Marmite, which is
I don't like.
No, well, that's the thing. Marmite, their tagline, it's that you put it on toast or bread or something in the morning, and it has a very distinctive flavor, and their tagline is, you either love it or you hate it. And my genre is that to a lot of people. Because some people love it and they love to be excited and they love the thrill of it. And some people don't like to be scared. And so, and I'm never going to win those people over.
That's right.
Which is that when I did Britain's Got Talent, I never expected that I would go as far as I did. I was in the final of that show.
You finished second, third?
You know what? I don't know.
It was all a blur?
No, I don't know. Once you're in the final, I think I wasn't in the top two. And after the top two, you don't know where you came, if that makes sense. But I was bewildered that I was there, and I'm very excited. But
how many times did you go before or perform to get to that point?
It's three performances in the UK. It's not as many as America. Hmm. And but the winner of that show, and I'm you know, he was a charming guy, but was a 90-year-old war veteran.
Had a good story.
He had a great story. He was a singer. I think probably he would admit he's not the world's best singer.
Yeah,
but you know, the producers put him standing on a carpet of poppies and there were, you know, pictures of his fallen comrades behind him and members of the armed forces in the audience.
I don't think Mother Teresa would fare any better.
No, exactly. Yeah. And so, and of course he stormed it.
Sure.
He won massively because, like I said, those shows are popularity contests.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that, you know, I think you have to go, if you're going to go do it, you have to go in with an agenda. And for me, it was about getting good footage, you know,
to launch you into doing what?
Well, just from the point of view of you know, if you have a unique act, if you have something that is original and interesting and you know, is going to get you work, in order to sell that, you have to have footage of it.
But your work is unique from almost everybody I talk with, and the standpoint, I mean, you're not going to be doing something in an intimate environment. You're not going to be doing strolling. You're not going to be performing at a wedding, you know.
No.
You know, things like this, and that your performances are stage performances or outdoors oftentimes or whatever, in which you're going to be having a large group of people, or you're perfectly suited for the theater, you know, that you're doing.
Sure.
So I think that would be, for many people, a hard nut to crack, because there are not many people as successful as you are in doing what you're doing and the other illusionists in touring with this. There might be a stage show that they can do from time to time, but this is, it was difficult to get, I would think, from where you were to where you are, but you're telling me, as I hear you, that you're using that for footage to try to launch, to get into this, basically.
No, it's not really about getting into it. It's just about, you know, ultimately, you know, what, as much as I love what I do, it's a business.
And, it is, exactly.
And so, you know,
you get treated like that.
Yeah, and the more people that know what I do, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
But did you have like a 5, 10, 15 year plan of like, okay, here's where I want to go, or
no,
just kind of let it fly wherever it lands?
My career was backwards, actually.
What do you mean?
Because I got into television first as a performer.
Magic.
Yeah, but also this stuff
okay,
too.
Okay.
So to give you the sort of the quick version of it, I grew up in Pembrokeshire, Southwest Wales. I had a mentor who taught me magic, and he was an elderly guy who wanted to pass on everything that he knew, you know. Mm-hmm. And he had a pretty good broad knowledge of magic generally. And so that was a very, you know, it was an interesting process, and that was like a 10-year relationship for me until he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a period of time when I wanted to be an actor, and so I went and did a degree in theatre in London, and was doing sort of close-up gigs and things like that at the same time. And one of those close-up gigs took me to Bristol, and which is a city near Bath in the UK, where I met Derren Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Because he lived there at the time and had just made his very first TV special. And we became friends. I would go and hang out with him.
He's a very nice guy.
Yeah, he's lovely and obnoxiously talented.
Why is he?
And
creative. And he surrounds himself with like people. You know, creative and...
Yeah. The group of people that were responsible for making that show are really, truly amazing. And I was fortunate enough to sort of get into that world and into that mix through my friendship with Derren. He lived with me for a while in London, and then I got the opportunity through that connection to try out for a TV show that they were making, which was a magic show. And so I made that show, and I wrote a whole bunch of it as well. I seemed to have a pretty natural sort of talent for coming up with ideas that worked for television.
For script. Screenwriting. Yeah.
Script and also just the high concepts of what would be a fun version of this. How do we make this work for TV? You know, it was just something that mm-hmm. I was naturally good at. And so I did that. I made 3 seasons of that show.
What was the name of the show?
That show was called Monkey Magic.
Okay. And I remember hearing about that.
Yeah, we did a bunch of those. And then...
It was a team of guys, right?
Yeah, it was me and 3 other guys.
Yeah.
The production company asked me to start working behind the camera as a consultant and producer and writer for some of the other shows, because they started to make a lot of shows. And I worked on Derren as well. I wrote and was a consultant for him, and they made a lot of magic. The owners of the company is a guy called Andrew O'Connor, and his business partner, Michael Vine, were both magicians. And so they had a real idea for how they could present magic well on television. And
was Michael Vine related to Tim Vine?
No.
Okay, never mind then.
They're not related. They were hugely successful at it. And you know, they did other things, game shows and sitcom shows and whatnot. And so that was kind of how I got into it. And then they made an escape artist special with an American escape artist. And it was the one show that they made where I feel like the producers didn't quite get it right. And the escape artist is very talented, very skilled guy.
Mm-hmm.
but the show wasn't very good. They tried to present it like a David Blaine special, like a mysterious thing. And I just had a very knee-jerk reaction to it. And I emailed the exec, Andrew, and I told him that I thought his show was bad, as a cocky 21-year-old or whatever. And rather than tell me, where to go, he said, "Well, film something and put your money where your mouth is then." So I did, and I filmed the thing. It's my philosophy about escapes, which has sort of morphed a little bit over time, but my reaction was that the reason that I wanted to do it was because I didn't like it, because I thought it was bad. Hmm. And I was like, I think I could do better.
Based upon what you had seen other people perform on television?
Based upon escapology generally. I really didn't like most of it. Hmm. And the reason there was like a manifesto that I created for myself probably in about 30 seconds, which is that what's wrong with it is that the jeopardy is always death, mm-hmm. which is unrealistic. They always escape and just in the nick of time.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, the restraints are things that mean nothing to the general public at all.
Mm, good point. Yeah, like you don't use straitjackets anymore, that kind of a thing.
Exactly. Like, in fact, the straitjacket is a perfect example because it has become the opposite of what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only time the public come into contact with a straitjacket is when they see someone taking it off, and usually like a sweater.
Yeah.
And so it not only do they know it's escapable, they know that's imminently what it is.
Right.
And so I was like, okay, well, I'm going to do it for real. I won't make the jeopardy death. If I fail, that's valid too, as theatrically, if I don't succeed.
You're not going to die.
I'm not going to die because it's... Sorry, I used to think, what's the worst thing that I would be willing to have happen to me
mm-hmm.
in a worst-case scenario, and then work backwards from that? So the very first thing that I did was I wanted to make it very gritty and real. I was really quite influenced by Jackass at the time, the Jackass TV show.
Yeah, I remember that.
So I did, I filmed the thing. It was very homemade intentionally. And I actually roped my dad into being sort of my foil in it. And so I was tied shirtless to a bed. And we put a bed sheet above me. Stretched, tied to the four corners of the bed above me, like, 2 feet above me. And then Dad got a hot iron and put it onto the sheet. So I had to escape before the iron fell through and hit me in the chest.
Yeah.
It's like a homemade version of Table of Death, basically. Mm-hmm.
Huh, that's interesting.
And I didn't succeed, and the iron burned through and it did hit me in the chest. And for a while I had an iron-shaped scar on my chest.
Wow. What a story.
But I sent that footage to the producer.
Of Jackass?
The producer of the other escape show, the guy that said, put your money where your mouth is. And he was like, okay, I get it. And so he was making a television show in the UK that was like a magazine studio-based show. And he gave me a spot in that every week. And so I made about six of those, like little mini homemade.
Did you come to them escapes. With an outline of here are the six escapes, or did you just figure out from week to week, or was it all shot
time? It was all shot, probably over the course of about two or 3 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. And then also I was involved as a producer in the other elements of the show.
Wow.
I was wearing many hats at that time. So I made that, and then my little section was probably the most successful part of that show. And so then they gave me a special, my own thing, which was I made a special called The Seven Stupidest Things to Escape From.
Which included what? Did you remember off the top of your head?
I did an escape where I was glued to a tree and tied to a dog. I did an escape So that was the thing. So I wanted to make the jeopardies, doesn't have to be death, and it certainly doesn't have to be, you know, injury. It could be humiliation. So we did an escape where we went to an office building, and I had told a bunch of my family and friends that there was a surprise party for me. Mm-hmm. And so they were going to surprise me standing at the outside an elevator door in the sort of the lobby of this office building, which we'd kind of hired. So they're all standing there at the bottom of the elevator. And meanwhile, myself and my dad are 15 floors up. Mm-hmm. And I get tied naked to a cart, like a dolly, and put into the elevator with my clothes.
Okay. And wow. Then, I see where you're going.
And then dad presses the button for the ground floor. So I had the time it took to escape.
Was there a camera in the...
Oh, yeah. Okay. The cameras everywhere. Yeah. The time it took to escape and put my clothes on before we hit the ground floor.
With all your friends.
Yeah.
And?
I got one hand out.
Well, hello.
Yeah. Yeah, it was very entertaining and kind of, you know, I'm sure whatever happened, it would have been funny and good.
Sure.
But it was, you know, from a point of view of impact on TV, it was probably the best case scenario. So we did a bunch of those things. I did a stunt, which actually didn't make it for numerous different reasons, but I was sewn up inside a dead cow as part of that.
I'd read about that, yeah. And that must have smelled horrible.
It was fresh. It was actually just like being, you know, in a butcher shop.
They'd gutted it and made room, and they sewed you up in it.
And then I escaped through its back passage. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
It was actually very difficult. I was restrained in it as well, so I had to escape from my restraints, then get out. And
through the bowels of the cow.
Yeah, it was very heavy. Couldn't really breathe. And
dark.
Yeah, very dark. It took me probably about 45 minutes to get out.
Was it just in a cow pasture, or where did they?
It was in a farmyard.
Yeah. Goodness sakes. Before I forget, you had talked about your dad being involved with something. Yeah. I remember when I'd completely forgotten the story until you just mentioned that my older son at the time was probably about, I think, maybe 9, 8, 9, 10, somewhere in there. And he wanted to be an escapologist, I guess. Sure. And so he would have me put my jacket on him, you know, and zip it up the backwards, you know. And then he would, you know, tie the arms together, basically, so his arms in front, then zip it up. I mean, it was like a parka, you know, basically, and put him in the closet, you know, and close the closet so it'd be dark and everything, and he'd have to try to get out of the jacket. And I remember talking to my wife at the time and thinking, you know, I hope we don't have a fire or something, you know, or somebody comes in just about the time he comes out of the closet, you know, you know, sweating, getting out of this. Like, what are you doing to your kid over here?
Sure.
And he said, do it again, Dad.
Yeah, I had exactly the same relationship with my dad. It was almost like, free babysitting for him because, you know, he would tie me up, put me, you know, tie me to the kitchen table or, you know, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And until I got good at it, they always knew where I was, you know.
Well, similar with a babysitter talking about, I forgot about this also, that I remember getting a phone call from the babysitter one time saying, where are the keys to the handcuffs? You know, because I think that she had convinced her to put him in handcuffs and do something, you know, and he wasn't getting out of them. And so, you know, they called us and said, oh, well, he hasn't really, you didn't continue that path.
Right. You're perhaps a bit relieved about that.
In a way. Yeah. That's right. That's right. So did your dad continue to kind of tour with you, travel with you now? Or?
No. I did. So after the Seven Stupidest Things, we made a show called Death Wish Live. So that was two live specials that I made in the same week. Mm-hmm. And the first special, I was hanged live on television.
And I heard that you had, that didn't go really according to...
No, I did not intend to be hanged. That was, yeah. It wasn't, I mean, we had done all of the sort of math requirements to know that it would be okay, but it was a real thing. And I did not get out. I dropped the shim that I was using to open the cuffs. So at that point, there was nothing I could do. I just had to wait for it to happen. It was very painful.
And you had rope burns for a long time.
A long time, yeah.
Ouch.
And then that was on the Monday of the week, and the Friday of the week we did Buried Alive. And I guess, you know, my work plays with people's fears and their phobias, you know? Mm-hmm. And everybody has a different thing. Everybody
like you've done, like
different.
With the scorpions in the mouth and that kind of a thing.
Exactly.
Okay.
And
the nail in the eye. I saw that picture. It's like, what the hell is that going on there?
and everybody's different. And for my dad, it was Buried Alive. Like that was the thing. He was like, because my dad was a cop and a fireman, so he's kind of a pretty clued in guy, and
he knows danger.
He knows danger pretty well, and usually after I would explain to him what I was about to do, he you know, the cameras would stop for a minute, and he'd go, okay, I get this. Have you thought about this? He would like, you know, double check all of the safety thinking and everything. But most of the time, he'd be like, yeah, okay, I get that. I would, you know, I would do that, or I would have done that.
Right.
Buried is the one thing he was like, no way, wouldn't do that. That's like freaky.
He's out.
He was out, and then to you know, it became a bit perverse to have to like. For him to stand there and watch me do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was that.
Yeah, that's my son. Yeah, exactly.
He didn't want to play anymore.
Okay, makes sense.
Ironically, Buried is something that I've done many times, and now actually a version of it I'm doing
on stage,
which I'm quite proud of because I think it's the first time anybody's done Buried on stage.
No, I don't. The only thing I can think of might be close to that would be... what was that? Todd Robbins had a thing in New York City, Play Dead, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And they had someone buried.
Oh, really?
You know, that supposedly that
Play Dead.
He would kill somebody with a shovel and buried him. Anyhow, it was Teller had helped work on this.
Yeah.
It was interesting. Speaking of that and Buried Alive kind of a thing, how would you differentiate what you do from what David Blaine might do? In other words, I think of David Blaine as kind of being... a performance artist from the standpoint that it's not so much he's trying to get out of something, but he's doing something as an endurance test.
Sure.
So that's a little bit different from trying to get out within a period of time, opposite of what you're doing, I guess, actually.
Yeah. I'm a big fan. I think he's amazing.
Yeah, he is.
I think that some of his things, I think, are a bit confused. But at the same time...
Like when he's standing on the pole? I never quite got that.
Yeah, not so much that one. I mean, it was just an iconic image. And if you've ever stood on a chair for any length of time, you know, that's not an easy thing to do.
Good point.
The one that really I didn't quite understand was the thing where he was in the ball underwater. Because he was handcuffed and... and it was an escape stunt, but at the same time he was trying to break the record for holding
endurance?
His breath underwater. So he was trying to get out and stay in at the same time, and that didn't make sense to me.
Get out and stay in, huh?
You know, those things are pulling in opposite directions. Now I know a lot of the people that work with him, and I have a feeling that might have been, I don't know this for sure, but I have heard that it was a TV producer's requirement that they were like, we've got to make this more than just holding your breath. Cause I think that's what he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the nature of television is that, you know, a lot of the time it's a very, you know, collaborative process and you can have thought about something for years and then, you know, some TV executive comes in and thinks about it for 2 minutes and then gives you an opinion. And sometimes that's good and sometimes it's not good at all.
Right.
I think it's one of the things that's fortunate that you know, he's the position that he has is very fortunate with the network that he, you know, and the deal that I know he has because I don't think they work to a great schedule. I'm good friends with Peter Clifford and Danny Garcia.
Yeah. And you know, Danny lives here in Houston.
Yeah, Lisa De La Vega, some of my best friends in Magic and really lovely people. And I think that they don't have a real hard time scale to when they have to deliver it.
That's true.
Which most TV shows absolutely
very tight, do, you know. Yeah, because they got a certain budget and you got to get it within that. Yeah, mm.
Yeah. And so from that point of view, he really is in a position to be able to come out with the best product that he possibly mm-hmm. can, mm-hmm. and it shows, because I think his certainly the last TV shows that he's done were extraordinarily good.
Have there been some escapes, and Jonathan, that you have done once and swore to never do again?
Maybe. There's certainly one that I've done twice and would never do again.
Okay.
I have twice done an escape where I was covered in bees. The first time was about 50,000 bees in the
second. Now, how do they do that? Did they cover you with honey first or something? Or?
Well, the second time was probably the most. The first time they literally just dumped them on me.
Okay.
And the second time I worked with a guy. I don't know whether he's still alive. He was quite elderly when I did this, and it would have been in about 2006.
In the UK?
In the States.
Oh, States.
Yeah, I made a series for Discovery Channel called One Way Out, and it was about the science of escapology. Hmm. And
it wasn't exposing things, I guess.
No, it was about it was really about the science of jeopardies. And I would talk, you know, there wasn't, because everything I was doing was real. I would talk a little bit about how you might pick open a lock or something like that. But we didn't really get into that stuff, mm-hmm. primarily because it's not that interesting. You know, the interesting stuff is the dangerous side of it. Mm-hmm. You know? And we would do a lot of testing and experiments, and then we would do whatever the stunt was. And so. The thing we were investigating in that episode of the show was that it was minimal movement, because usually if you're escaping from something, you need to move very vigorously in order to get out.
Mm-hmm.
But what I posed the question, what would happen if the situation you were in that moving was really bad, you know, then how do you get out?
Yeah, when you have bees all over you.
Exactly. So I was covered in 200,000 bees and standing on a washing machine. I was in a box, but on a washing machine. And it was set to 30 seconds before spin cycle. Hmm. So I had to escape before the whole thing got shaken very violently.
And these bees were attached?
They were literally on, no, they were literally on me. Yeah. So Norman Gary, who was the bee expert, he was and for the longest time he was the guy to go to in Hollywood for bees.
Wow.
He killed Macaulay Culkin in My Girl with bees.
Okay. Not literally, but yeah.
No, he was the person that had isolated the pheromone that the queen emits. Hmm. And so he had a little vial of it. And I wore basically like a giant stocking. And
they'd been soaked in that thermal.
He just put tiny little dabs of it all over me, and then he would throw them in the air. He'd get like a scoop, like you'd see in a grocery store or something, and of bees, and throw them in the air, and they would just come and land on me. It took a long time. It took probably about an hour to get covered. And
talk
just
about standing for a long time.
Standing
and
still.
You're waiting for bees to come and light on you.
Yeah.
Goodness.
Until I was completely covered, head to toe.
And standing on a washing machine.
Standing on a washing machine, and then we did it. Yeah, I was stung about 30 times, and went into toxic shock afterwards, because you just can't process that amount of.
So, what were you trying to escape from? You were trying to.
So I was tied up. My wrists were tied together.
Okay.
In the box, and then I had to get out of the box as well. The box was locked.
With the bees on you in the box, locked and on top, and the box was on top of the sewing machine.
Built onto the top.
So you weren't standing on top of the machine. You were in
no.
The box.
I was standing on top of. I was standing on the washing machine. The box was on top of the washing machine, and I'm inside the box.
Inside. I got you now. I'm with you. I visualize. Okay.
Okay.
So you got out of that with only 30 stings.
I got 30 stings, and it was
only.
It was a lot, and. The reason that I did it again was because when I had done it with 50,000, it didn't look right. It didn't look...
When they dumped them on you, you mean?
Yeah, it didn't look how I wanted it to look. Mm-hmm. And so then we did it again for One Way Out, and it was exactly right. It's exactly what I visualized.
Okay. So I've done it, been there, not doing one back.
Yeah. It really sucks. That's
well, what about the shark thing? I would think that'd be another thing that I don't know that I want to go and try again.
No, that I would do all day long. I'm a water person, so I love all of that stuff. And we did... that was actually... wasn't an escape. It was... a Shark Week special.
Okay.
I made a Shark Week special called How Not to Become Shark Bait.
And
we looked at what are statistically the five stupidest things to do in shark-infested water.
And that would be?
Swimming at dawn and dusk, wearing high-contrast colors, spearfishing is another good one, splashing at the surface... And there was another one. It's a long time ago. I remember the one that worked actually was high contrast colors. It's the same science as a fishing lure. You know, a shark is
attracted to that.
Naturally attracted to something that looks interesting,
shiny object.
Yeah, and even though there was a Caribbean reef shark that bit me
on your leg,
You know, if they're going to come and investigate, they don't have hands that they can look at something.
Oh,
so they're going to use their mouths. So it wasn't necessary. It was just seeing what I was. And I was wearing chainmail. I was dressed as a clown is what they had me do.
The big contrasting colors, certainly.
Yeah. And it came in. The thing that happens, though, when you're wearing chainmail is the sharks have serrations on their teeth. And so
it gets stuck in the chain.
Yeah, the bite of the shark wasn't horrendous. I've been bitten by an attack dog for another thing. A German Shepherd has a way more powerful bite, actually. But what they do is they use their teeth like we would use a fork. So they hold the prey, and then they anchor their body in the water, and they thrash side to side, and the serrations of their teeth saw through whatever it is they're holding on to.
Like a carving into a tree.
Yeah, exactly. And then they get a mouthful. Well, when you're wearing chainmail, you're entirely right. The serrations get caught in the links of the chain, and you end up with a shark attached to you.
But they can't get loose.
Yeah.
It's even worse.
Yeah. So you have to, it's sort of counterintuitive. You have to kind of hug them and like help it off. So yeah, it was an interesting experience. I would do that again. I really want to do a great white thing. Actually, that's one of the things on my list.
Now, when we first started talking about the illusionist and about how it's different and trying to create then a persona and a person that people care about, that I recall it used to be like Kevin would be the inventor, and I think Adam Trent was, I don't know. Everybody had like the something that they were, and so you know, it would seem that you could have that an escapologist. Interchange with another escapologist instead of Jonathan Goodwin. But what you're saying now is that they really have characters that are you, and people care about Jonathan, not just an escapologist.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. And I think that certainly there is a level of interchangeability within the product, you know, within the show. So that, you know, you can go and see. There are other versions of this show. There's usually about three versions of it touring the world right now.
Isn't Charlie Fry with, like, they still doing the 1905 or whatever?
No, that...
Because David was with that, too.
I was actually in the original cast of that show. So David does the circus version. So David is the ringmaster of Circus 1903.
Is that still touring?
It does, yeah. Okay. The magic show... was wonderful, and I, in my opinion, was maybe the best version of The Illusionists from the point of view of a theatrical magic show that, that they've done. But it would have been a very expensive show to tour. We took it to Broadway. I played the Broadway. One of the main reasons is the cast of that show was just very, very difficult to get to tour together, as everybody's so busy. You know, Charlie and Sherry is the, you know, two of the busiest working professionals, you know.
I think Charlie's the new Johnny Thompson. You know, I mean, he just knows a little bit of everything about everything.
Charlie is obnoxious. He is Charlie is the most talented human being I think I've ever met. Yeah. He could do any of our acts and better than us. He's just he's a Renaissance man, actually, Charlie Fry. I love him dearly. Yeah. They're very, very wonderful. Mm-hmm. And so he's, you know, they're all saying they're retiring. I'll like to see it when it happens.
Yeah, exactly. Johnny Thompson retired too.
Yeah.
Not until he died.
They're constantly working, you know. Rick and Tara, Rick Thomas, have an amazing residency in Branson. And so they're doing that show. They just have had a little baby.
I've got a framed poster in my office of him.
He's wonderful.
Yeah, great guy.
He's such a great performer. One of the great things about doing the 1903 show is that we would do a thing in the middle of the show where we would all be on stage together and we would all have audience members with us, and we would all do a little something. We call it the parlor.
At the same time? So it's kind of like a ring, different three-ring circus going on kind of thing?
No, we'd take it in turns.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
But we were all on stage while we took it in turns.
I see.
And I just got to sit and watch Rick Thomas every day do his watch routine, which is just a masterclass. It was so wonderful. Mm-hmm. They're fabulous. And then also we had Tommy and Amelie in that show, who were, you know, sought after around the world. So the idea of now trying to put that show back together again is almost impossible
because that everyone's successful in their own careers and on their own tours. I mean, I just saw, you know, Tommy and Amelie over in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and just a few months ago, you know, and they were on the way to New Orleans. I mean, they're just all over the place.
All over the world. So it was a great show, but that one's, I think, probably seen its last performance, which is a shame. But I was glad to have been involved in it.
Yeah, that is great. That's great. Well, so this particular tour, are you in the middle, the beginning? Where are you approximately?
We are maybe coming up to the beginning of the last third. We're over halfway.
And will you take a break and then come back then again in the fall, or?
Yes, I mean, I think so.
That's kind of plan.
There is, it usually sort of gears up, and maybe we'll go away and do a different version or other things in the summer. Last year, I was in the West End with the show in the summer. Mm-hmm.
With this show, with the Illusionist, same guys.
In the summer, it wasn't the same guys.
Oh, it wasn't
completely,
okay.
Completely different cast. Yeah, and then
There was another touring Illusion show. Faye Presto was involved with for a while in the UK.
Champions of Magic. Yeah, it was produced by a friend of mine called Alex Jarrett. And they're doing really great things.
They're still touring, actually.
Yeah. And that's a fun little show.
But that's
actually
just in the UK. Are they going to Europe?
They're actually predominantly in America.
They're
traveling across the States.
Okay.
Too. Yeah. I know, very recently they were up in Canada. But that's a great show. I don't think Faye is in the show anymore.
No, she left some time ago.
And I haven't seen it for a little while. But I'm friends with the cast of that show, and they're all good guys.
Mm-hmm. And so during the time that you're off, do you have other things that you do, or you have like your own little tour? I say little, you know, and going out and doing something, or do you just kind of come up with some other ideas, or go back to work on TV?
I do all sorts of different things. That's one of the things that I love about my life, really, is that it's forever variable. So, you know, I might go and work a little bit in television. A year ago or 2 years ago, I guess it was now, I was asked to go and create all of the finale stunts for Drummond Money Coutts's Netflix special.
Yes.
So I wasn't involved in the shoot at all, but I
wasn't wild about that.
No, I haven't actually.
Personally?
I haven't seen it. And I think it was a bit of a... It was a bit of a...
it's kind of slow, I thought.
Yeah, it was a bit... And it was a bit of an odd concept. You know, when they called me up about it and said, you know, we're going to do, you know, magic tricks that have killed people, And Drummond's a nice guy, but he's not a stunt performer. He's a close up
guy, right?
Magician, and so he was very much out of his element in a lot of that stuff.
But I was also wondering what you were saying about that the producer may have come in and said, "Here's what I want," and so they may have had some plans which might have been different. Because I said there was something.
It was a very mixed bag. There were lots of cooks in the kitchen.
That's what I thought.
And at the same time, when I first went in and I spoke to them about it, I was like, "Well, this is maybe a bit of a foolish commission because they were struggling to come up with eight in season one." And so if you can't come up with eight in season one,
you're not having season two.
Season two is going to be a real stretch.
Yeah.
And I think that was borne out really. I think it may have been a lesson in sticking to the things that speak to you most.
Right.
Like I said, he's a very charming and very talented close-up magician. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that's the sort of the direction that is perhaps most fitting for him.
So what do you see yourself doing the next 5 years? Continuing to tour? You got some other ideas? I mean, you're a young man.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm going to do the America's Got Talent show this year.
Okay, good luck.
Thank you.
Penn and Teller Fool Us, maybe? Doing something like that, too?
Possibly. I mean, I'm not really... That's the thing about what I do, is that I'm not really trying to fool anybody. But I'm certainly going to do the
AGT.
I didn't expect to enjoy Britain's Got Talent, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
What was that? I mean, what was the experience that made it? Just the people you worked with, the producers, the people backstage,
all of it,
the fun of
all of it. And you know, I've done quite a lot of television shows.
Yeah.
And my experience up until that point had been doing other people's television shows is very, very difficult and usually quite unpleasant because the agenda is all about them and you are a cog in a wheel, and quite often, you know, those shows like talk shows, I've done, you know, Jimmy Kimmel and Jonathan Ross in the UK and Rachel Ray, and they're real machines. And quite often it's hard. The priority is never you and what you're doing. It's always about the show and the host.
Yeah.
And so to go in and get those things how you want them, and to portray, for them to portray what you're doing in its best light, is very difficult, very stressful. And it's possible, and you know, it's something that I've done a bunch of, but it's not pleasant.
Yeah.
Whereas the BGT show, actually, everybody was charming. They were super respectful. They wanted it to be how I wanted it to be. And
so they made it more about you rather than about Simon. And
yeah, and not necessarily. Obviously, you know, the star of that show is Simon Cowell and the judges. And that's fine. But from the point of view of the process of it, it was really nice. There were great to work with, very collaborative, and they just trusted me. You know, it was very clear to me from the very beginning that they had a level of respect for me and what I do.
Let you do what you wanted to
and
do.
They kind of let me do what I wanted to do.
Did you get on because you had approached them, or have you got an agent that contacted them, or how did that come about?
I'm not supposed to say this, but they had asked me to go on it every year for 10 years, and I'd always said no.
I'd gotten phone calls, you know, here in the U.S. Sure. Also for AGT. It's like, hey, we're going to be in Dallas or San Antonio. So in my case, I don't have an in-game. I don't have a theater show that I want to put butts in the seats. I'm not working in Vegas, and so, and I don't need a reel, and I'm getting older. It's kind of like, so I've just never just said no, thank you.
Yeah, you have to go into it with an agenda.
Yeah.
And I kind of had an agenda, a reason that I wanted to do it. We were doing the show in the West End, in the Illusionist show, and so for me it was a twofer really. It was you know, have an experience and get some good footage,
right,
and then also get some good promo for the theater show that we were going to do. And that was it really, because I don't live in the UK anymore. I live in Las Vegas, so that was sort of a closed agenda for me. But the States, I don't really have a big profile here. Nobody really knows who I am.
Yeah. Until they listen to this podcast.
Yeah, well, exactly. So that's kind of it, you know, that, you know, do that show and see what comes of it. I love being in The Illusionists, but I live my life on stage in periods of 8 minutes, and I would like to do something a little more, you know, something that's longer and something that is my show.
Yeah, I understand.
And if it gives me the opportunity to do that, would be great. And the other thing that I would like to do, and this is, you know, maybe a separate or joined goal, is work from home. You know, I've been touring with this show for 6 years, and
be nice to have your own show in Vegas, so you just don't have to go anyplace.
I want to be able to commute to work.
Yeah,
you know?
Be like Matt King.
Exactly. Everybody wants to be like Matt King.
Doesn't everybody?
Goodness, yeah, absolutely.
In so many ways. Well, listen, as we start to wrap up, first of all, let me thank you again for your time, and it's been
pleasure.
Delightful. I've just loved everything you had to say. I'm just
thank you.
I'm on the tip of the spear, you know, to just in the anticipation of everything you're going to be saying. It's very, very interesting. But the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, and I always like to close by asking the guests, what is it that your philosophy of life, what is it that's your, I say magic word, but it could be, what is your chi, you know, when you wake up in the morning, what is it that drives you? Not a word, it could be a phrase, a philosophy of life.
I mean, it's funny that you say that, actually, because I just, I've, in the last couple of months, last probably 3 months, I have got two tattoos.
Okay.
And I'd never had them before. It's never been a thing that was interesting to me, but I kind of shifted my opinion. And so on my right arm, I have a Latin phrase that says sine metu, which is without fear. And then I just turned 40 in February, and on my 40th birthday, I got this tattooed on my arm, which is
holy cow,
which is a quote that says, "So I struggled and fought. I have done and abstained. I've tortured my body and risked my life, only for that to have one plank on the stage where they must fall back and cry, Master Harry Houdini."
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah. Maybe more than you were asking me for, but I think that's kind of it. Is I love what I do, and I love coming up with new and crazy ideas. I try and put in my show, in everything I do, I try and put in a moment that I call the expletive moment, where, you know, I'm explaining something, the audience is going along for the ride, but I leave one piece of information out until the very last moment. And just before we go, I let them have that last piece of information. And now the whole thing makes sense.
Then it all comes together.
And the audience go, oh, no. They don't say, oh, no, but
yeah.
you get the point. And for me, that's what it's about. It's about creating that moment for an audience. Certainly.
Got it. So create that moment for the audience. Thank you very much, Jonathan.
A pleasure.
It's been fantastic.
Thanks.
So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was Jonathan Goodwin, and this is Scotty Young. Well, that was a good one, actually, Jonathan Goodwin. And I thank you, Jonathan, for being my guest this week and for taking some time to chat with us here in your dressing room. And that was just fantastic. I know that you had other things on your mind to prepare for later for the evening show. And I know how much this really means to the rest of the listeners also to hear these kinds of stories that you shared. And they were pretty phenomenal. This was really, really enlightening to me. And I hope to a lot of you listeners as well, and that you've enjoyed this as much as I did getting to meet and chat with my new friend, Jonathan Goodwin. So if you ever get a chance to see him, whether it's going to be on television or in a live performance, please go out of your way and make some time to watch this incredible performer. Wow, always got a lot of really good ideas, and he's got some good things in here that he talked about, I think, too, that can apply towards your performance and as well. So anyhow, thanks again, Jonathan. This was great. Well, listen, I want want to wrap up and again thank our sponsor, themagicbookshop.com, and remind everybody that we are going to have another week on the contest. We've been running a contest for $100 of free books, compliments of Eric Citron, who is the owner and proprietor of themagicbookshop.com, and he is going to send you $100 worth of magic books, $100 of his choice, retail value, and if you live in the U.S., the shipping will be free. If you're living outside the U.S., then he'll calculate the foreign postage, and if you're willing to pay for that postage, then he will send that to you. If not, then we'll draw then an alternate name. So again, you have one more week to sign up for this contest. It's been running for the last couple weeks, and we have quite a few contestants who have registered so far, have thrown their names in the hat, so to speak. If you'll just go to themagicwordpodcast.com, there at the bottom of this week's blog and the last 2 weeks' blogs, actually, there is a registration form where that you can enter for a chance to win $100 of books, magic books, compliments of themagicbookshop.com. Also, that I want to remind you that there is a 15% promo code that if you put in magic word when you check out, that you'll get 15% off of all of your purchases. He always throws in an extra magic book. Whenever you order something, he'll throw in something else for free. Plus, you get the 15% for listening to the podcast. So again, just put in magic word and get something kind of cool. So listen, thank you guys very much for listening here this week. And one last thing, I want to encourage you to go to the website, to themagicwordpodcast.com, where you always get additional content, and in particular, towards the end of this conversation, that he talks about the tattoos that he has on his arm, and I show you a close-up of that that is kind of interesting to see. And so, it's worth looking at, so go take a peek. Until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to give your audiences that aha, or oh, what the heck happened there? Kind of experience. This is Scotty out.